Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
Quiet on set.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today.
The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Many years ago, in gloomy halls of marble, six men clothed in black gathered around a table. Two sides, the Council of National Resource Defense and the behemoth Chevron, stood opposed before them, quarreling over the elusive stationary source. The men in black sat with faces of stone and listened, and then they filed out one by one. When they returned, their command was clear. The stationary source belonged to the EPA, not Chevron. The courts would defer to the agencies. But this decision, arcane as it may have seemed at the time, would linger through the years. For try as they might, the men and courts that followed could not reconcile this command. And so it grew and grew, taking on a life of its own. Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Anne Hartley, your horrific host. You may have heard of the Chevron Doctrine. We made a film on it a few years back called Chevron Accidental Landmark. The Chevron Doctrine didn't start as a landmark decision at the Supreme Court, but its growth, preeminence, decline, and recent demise both fascinate and mystify observers. I have here with me Gary Lawson, a professor at Florida Levin College of Law and easily one of the foremost experts on Chevron. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's a delight to have you here. So, do you remember when the Chevron decision first came out?
Well, strange you say that. I was actually clerking on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in the fall of 1984, when what we know today as the Chevron Doctrine got created. The Chevron case came down in June of 1984, but there really wasn't anything called a Chevron Doctrine until, at the very least, months later. And not really a doctrine until probably 1986 or 1987. And it did not come out of the Supreme Court. It came out of the D.C. Circuit. So I was, to some extent, there at the creation, but not in the place where people might think it was created.
So it started out as like just your normal Supreme Court decision, and then it got taken and made into something more.
That's exactly right. The Supreme Court and everybody who argued to the Supreme Court did not think that they were deciding any grand questions of statutory interpretation or judicial review. They had a reasonably important administrative law case. They thought the D.C. Circuit had gotten it wrong. Wasn't even presented in the Chevron opinion as a question of statutory interpretation. The last part of the opinion where they say the agency wins was under a subheading of the opinion called policy. So that's what they thought they were deciding. Some lower courts had other ideas. It's really in the fall of 1984, about 3-4 months after the Chevron decision comes down, that a few panels on the D.C. Circuit started treating the Chevron decision as a general transformation of the way they were going to approach agency decisions of law on review. That got battled around in the lower courts for, I would say, roughly 2 years before the dust settled and the lower courts settled on the Chevron Doctrine, as we now call it, as their mode of interpretation. The Supreme Court had no idea any of this was happening during those 2 years. I know we have limited time, but this is like one very important piece of the history that I think people miss, particularly given the political valence of the Chevron Doctrine today. When the lower courts started tentatively creating this Chevron Doctrine, there was opposition. There was opposition on the D.C. Circuit. There was opposition on other courts of appeals as well. And it did not fall across partisan lines at all. The early Chevron Doctrine opinions were written by Pat Wald, right? A justifiable icon of the left for a long time. Her strongest supporter for this new doctrine was Ken Starr, moderate Republican. The two D.C. Circuit judges who were fighting tooth and nail against this were the strange bedfellows of Robert Bork and Harry Edwards. On other circuits, some of the strongest early opponents of Chevron were Alex Kaczynski and Stephen Breyer. So this was not seen as a partisan issue on the courts of appeals. The Academy saw it as a partisan issue. If you go back to the legal scholarship of the late 1980s, a time when there were no prominent conservative academic administrative law scholars. Tom Merrill was in the Department of Justice at that time, not in the Academy. The academic reaction to this emerging Chevron doctrine was almost universally negative, hostile, sometimes even hysterical, because it affected a modest transfer of power from courts to agencies. And who were the agencies in the 1980s? Well, those were Reagan agencies. So the political valence at the time was, oh my God, we can't have this. Fast forward that 30 years and tells you something about the Academy. But anyway, just that background of how the Chevron doctrine came about and what its original reaction was is something that the youngins of today who did not live through it might not appreciate.
Sure. So it sounds like it definitely didn't start out on traditional partisan lines.
No, and not at all.
It didn't really shift to that until more recently.
Not in the courts, at least. At the Academy, it was all partisan, but it was all negative. This is a horrible thing. Marbury versus Madison, separation of power, all sorts of arguments about why it was an awful breach of judicial responsibility to give the agencies all this power.
So it was the academics who were opposed to the Chevron doctrine on the basis of separation of powers, and then it was the Reagan administration that supported it?
Well, yes, the Department of Justice was, once the Chevron decision comes down, there's this language that the author of the Chevron opinion, Justice Stevens, did not intend to be transformative. No justice thought was transformative. 3 years later, Justice Stevens writes an opinion for four other justices saying, no, we didn't mean that. But yeah, the Department of Justice litigators ran with that language, and several panels on the D.C. Circuit and eventually on other lower courts bought it. But it was probably not until late 1986, early 1987 that you could say that the lower courts had definitively settled on this new Chevron doctrine as their way of reviewing agency legal interpretations. It wasn't like they never gave deference to agencies before that. They did. There were lots of circumstances where they gave deference to administrative interpretations, including whole categories of administrative interpretations, mostly in circumstances where the agency was filling out the meaning of a statute through case-by-case adjudications. You're an employee, you're not an employee, you're an employee, you're not an employee. You do that 50 times and you have a definition of an employee. What the Chevron doctrine did was extend that presumptive deference to all agency legal interpretations, even if you were just staring at the words on the page and the agency says, okay, here's what they mean. That took hold, as I say, over a period of about 2 years, 2.5 years after the 1984 Chevron decision.
Gotcha. So as I understand it, Chevron is about judicial review, right?
Yes, judicial review.
Why does that matter?
Well, a great many statutes are handled first by federal administrative agencies before the courts ever see them. If a case involving the meaning of a statute goes straight to a court and there's no administrative agency in between the event and the court just tries to decide what it thinks the best meaning of the statute is. It's not going to start out with a thumb and two elbows on the side of one of the parties. What happens, though, if the court gets the statutory question after a federal administrative agency has already opined on what it thinks the statute means? And as I said, over a range of cases for a very long time, courts have quite often given a good measure of deference to those agency interpretations, sometimes just because there were circumstances suggesting that maybe the agency was in a good position to get the right answer. And sometimes, as I said, when the statute was being built out piece by piece over a sequence of decisions over time, tied to the particular facts and circumstances of individual cases. In those circumstances, courts had been giving a good deal of weight to agency interpretations for quite a while. What the Chevron doctrine says, though, is that when a statute comes up, we're not sure what it means, federal agency gives its interpretation, even if it's an interpretation that a law professor could come up with sitting in a room staring at the words on the page. Even in those circumstances, courts are supposed to give a strong presumption, if you will, that the agency interpretation is correct. If the statute is really clear, the agency is wrong, then no, they don't win. If they come up with an interpretation of a hard-to-interpret statute that just looks crazy, no, they're not going to win. But there's a very large range of circumstances where statutes, even if you think they have answers, don't necessarily have clear or unambiguous answers. And in those zones, the Chevron doctrine means that the agency is going to win in some set of circumstances where if you just sat down and thought through what's the right answer, the agency might lose. So as I say, it's a modest transfer of interpretative authority from courts to administrative agencies.
Gotcha. So if it's a modest transfer, why has the Chevron doctrine cast such a long shadow over administrative law?
I'm glad you asked that question because I've puzzled about it for 40 years. As I say, I was sort of a firsthand witness to the whole episode, and I've been involved in administrative law for 40 years. And somebody who searches my entire corpus of scholarship will never find me opining one way or another on whether I think this whole episode was a good thing or a bad thing. Because I've actually never thought that it mattered nearly as much as other people do. If one thinks that it is a good idea for administrative agencies to have a great deal of discretion in figuring out how to adapt vague congressional statutes to the modern world, the Chevron doctrine seems like a fine plan. If you think that agencies are likely to be abusing their authority, seizing on every possible opportunity to expand their power in pursuit of whatever their agenda happens to be at the time, then maybe the Chevron doctrine isn't such a great idea. Although that also depends on your comparative assessment of agencies versus courts. It's not like the courts are always going to be 100% correct in getting the right answer. So it's not that it's irrelevant. It's not that it makes no possible difference in any cases. There are some cases that will come out differently. I've just never thought that it was as large a number of those cases as most people think. Here's my hypothesis, and I phrase it as a hypothesis because I have no definitive proof. This is just my sense from observing this process, sometimes from the inside, mostly from the outside, over 40 years. Go back to 1984. Why is it that lower courts would seize on some isolated language in a Supreme Court opinion that just obviously, if you read it, was not trying to change the law? There's no way to sit down and read the Chevron opinion and think this is designed to be a transformative opinion. Why would they do that? And you can come up with all sorts of answers about considerations of, well, structural constitutionalism and relative competence. Maybe those are the answers, but this is what's always nagged at me. If you go back even to the beginning of the 20th century, before there was an Administrative Procedure Act, before Congress was writing statutes specifying forms of judicial review, courts had to figure out how they were going to review decisions of the relatively few but important federal administrative agencies that you had, like the Interstate Commerce Commission regulating transportation. And one of the first things that federal courts did was decide that when those agencies found facts, forget the law for a moment, when they found facts The courts were not going to get involved in trying to figure out whether the agency found the facts correctly or not. They were essentially going to treat those agencies basically the way you treat juries, unless it's just obviously stupid on the face of things. They're going to let it go. Now, they did that not because there were statutes instructing them to do that. Those statutes instructing them to do that came later, after the courts had already started doing it. They did it because courts don't want to be bothered with getting down into the nitty-gritty of fact-finding. It's a way of managing your docket. All right, fast forward to 1984. A lot of the statutes that Congress writes are dense, technical, poorly drafted, ambiguous. Trying to slog through those to figure out what's the right answer in any given case is not necessarily a fun or happy enterprise. And those issues come embedded in challenges to agency actions that also involve challenges to their fact-finding and their policy-making and their exercises of discretion. These things are soul-killingly dull. Courts need a way to get these cases off their desk. And deferring to an agency is a good way to do that. It's a lot easier most of the time to figure out whether an agency is unreasonable than to figure out whether the agency is correct. And if that's even partially right, that's even partially the reason why this Chevron doctrine got created in the first place, because it was going to make the job of courts easier in a very, very difficult set of circumstances. One of the reasons I don't think the doctrine changes all that much, if that tool is not available, if that vocabulary, that language is not available, there are plenty of other ways courts can figure out to deal with agency decisions other than slogging through and figuring out the right answer. There's an old case from 1944, long before Chevron, that says, yeah, go ahead and give agency interpretations of statutes whatever weight you think they're worth. It looks like the agency thought about it really hard and maybe know something about it. Sure, give them a measure of weight. That doctrine is still there. Nothing the Supreme Court did in June of 2024 changes that one bit. It's also possible for courts to look at what agencies say about statutes and quite reasonably say, well, yeah, it looks like they're interpreting a statute, but that's not really what they're doing. To take the Chevron case itself, right? The words in the statute say you need a certain regulatory regime for stationary sources of pollution. If something is a stationary source, you can't increase the amount of pollution that comes out of it under a whole range of circumstances. Okay, what's a stationary source? Is a stationary source a factory that's got 5 smokestacks? Well, one sense, of course, it's a stationary source. It's a source and it's stationary. The factory isn't going to get up and walk away. But each of the smokestacks, are they stationary sources? Sure, they're stationary. They're not walking away and they're also sources. You can stare at that statute as long as you want and it won't tell you whether stationary source means just the smokestack or whether it means the 5 smokestacks located within a few feet of each other. The statute isn't going to tell you that. So it looks like the agency's interpreting a statute, but it's not really interpreting a statute. It's making a policy judgment about how to handle its pollution permitting regime, right? And there's a whole different method for judges to review agency policy determinations that do involve a non-trivial amount of deference to the agency. So one other way to do what I think courts are going to want to do, and that's get rid of these cases, is recharacterize, not necessarily wrongly, things that come up that are now presented, or at least have been up till now, presented as questions about the interpretation of a statute. Not really interpreting the statute. It's not the words of the statute that we're trying to give content to. The agency made a policy call and we have to evaluate the merits of its policy call. So there's lots of room for courts to do essentially what the Chevron doctrine did over a range of cases. Could there be some where none of those tools will work? Sure. So could abolishing the Chevron doctrine change the outcome in a number of cases? Sure. I just don't think it's going to be nearly as big an impact as a lot of other people in this business do.
So with Loper-Bright killing off the Chevron doctrine, it sounds like the lower courts are just going to kind of continue on their course.
We won't know that for another 5 years until we have enough cases to create the database to make that judgment. I know there are other people in the administrative law world who I've talked to who think I'm wrong, who think it will make a huge difference. I'm not sure what the empirical test of those competing hypotheses would even look like. Just reporting my sense of what it is that generated these deference doctrines in the first place. I don't think it was deep jurisprudence. I think it was docket management. And if that's true, there are other ways to manage a docket than citing the Chevron case 18,000 times over the last 40 years. But I could be wrong. About that.
We'll have to check back with you in 2029.
I think that's correct. I think that's right. We'll know in 5 years. Let me throw one other thing out there.
Before I forget it.
To some extent, the Chevron doctrine has been maybe, I think, more controversial than its effect maybe warrants, because it's become something of a stand-in for larger questions about the administrative state. If you look at the political valence of it over the last decade, most of the criticisms of the Chevron doctrine have come from critics of the administrative state. And the defenses of the Chevron doctrine, almost the exact opposite of what you saw 35 years ago in the mid to late 1980s, have come from supporters of it. I think that there have been a number of movements in other areas of doctrine having nothing to do with the Chevron doctrine, where there are some things that would not have been considered serious elements of doctrine 50 years ago that are now considered serious today. And I think the Chevron debate is getting some of the spillover effects, perhaps, from some of those other doctrines. People really want to argue about whether or not there should be a vigorous subdelegation doctrine limiting the amount of power Congress is able to give to administrative agencies. And Chevron becomes something of a proxy for that battle. Just throwing that out there.
Well noted. It's not Chevron. It's everything around it.
Possibly.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you today, Gary.
No, thank you.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you for giving a legal academic the opportunity to spout things.
It's what we love to hear. Thank you, folks, for listening in. You can find the link to our film, Chevron, Accidental Landmark, in the description on our YouTube channel or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.